This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When President Obama started working on health care reform, proponents wanted a single-payer system that would cover everyone with the promise of lowering the nation's overall health care costs. But on its road through Congress, the original proposal became a bill shaped by the health care industry. And some experts say it is now unlikely to alter the ever-increasing trajectory of health care costs, workforce shortages, or the health behavior of most Americans. One of those experts is Steve Jacob, an award-winning healthcare journalist and author of the new book, Healthcare in 2020, Where Uncertain Reform, Bad Habits, Too Few Doctors, and Skyrocketing Costs Are Taking Us. The picture he paints of our medical reality is in just 8 short years is not a pretty one, but he offers some suggestions on how we can all gain greater control over both our personal interaction with healthcare and its spiraling costs, and he joins us to share some of that information this hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike. I'm really glad to be here.
Nice to have you. Actually, you're in Dallas, and I'm here, so but it's like, technology is a wonderful thing.
It is a wonderful thing.
Before we talk about the future of healthcare, let's talk about you, because prior to writing your book, you were an award-winning healthcare columnist, may still be, for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, with your columns being distributed by the McClatchy Service, which is a company that owns the Charlotte Observer here locally. And you've spent 40 years writing about health policy for newspapers and magazines and healthcare organizations. What has happened over those 40 years that you've been writing about this to get us where we are today, a situation in which so many people can't afford healthcare, many people and businesses struggle to pay for health insurance, and the whole system threatens to bankrupt the country?
Well, basically, ever since 1960, which, of course, is well before those 40 years kicked in, healthcare costs have been running ahead of consumer price index by about 2 percentage points. And, you know, when that started a long time ago, that was building on a very small base. But now, because healthcare costs have become so expensive, now you're looking at, again, when you're looking at medical inflation that's running ahead of consumer price index, that's now building on a very large base. So healthcare reform has been part of the American agenda for most of the last century. Mm-hmm. It really started with FDR. He tried to do it and then backed off. And then pretty much every president ever since FDR has tried to reform healthcare. And really, only two presidents have really succeeded with that. One is LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was able to push through Medicare and Medicaid, and then secondly, Barack Obama with the most recent health reform. There was, you know, obviously the bigger effort over the past few years was Bill Clinton, and he was never really able to get that off the ground. Mm-hmm. And we've had ebbs and flows in healthcare over the past several decades, but really we're now at a point where it is extremely expensive and is going to continue to be so.
When FDR tried to reform healthcare, was he doing it to control costs, or was he doing it to bring access to more people?
He was trying to bring access to more people. Essentially, he wanted to do, you know, the healthcare version of Social Security.
Right.
And so, you know, he was really for universal health care, but he ran into some real opposition from the American Medical Association, and he felt like he had bigger battles to fight, and he was never able to push it through.
So tell me why health care costs are increasing so exponentially. What is it that's driving them up?
You know, people speculate about a lot of things as to why this is happening. But if you look at the research, there's really two major causes of healthcare inflation. One is technology. And it's not just medical technology that is improving healthcare, but the idea is usually this technology is created. Unlike other industries, it does not bring down costs. It actually causes costs to rise. And then once this technology is available, that technology is applied to a population larger than it was originally intended. So that basically once the technology is there, then it's dispersed widely. And because what's specific about healthcare and what's different about the healthcare economy versus other sectors is this is supplier-induced demand. In other words, when you go to the doctor, he or she pretty much tells you what you need to do, what tests you need to take, what procedures you need to have. And so it's a really in a unique position. And really, the only other sector of the economy that's like this is auto repair, in the sense that you know, you bring your car in,
you're
and
out there
if the
mercy.
Mechanic says you got to do, you know, you got to do X, Y, Z, or you're going to break down on the highway, you do it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't, it's at your own peril. So the supplier-induced demand allows this broad use of technology, and it's widely dispersed. The other piece of it is really the prices, what I call in my book market power, that there are certain healthcare organizations around the country, not so much in North Carolina and Texas, but on both coasts, that are able to command price increases far in excess of what their expense increases are because they must be in their networks.
Plus, nobody knows what the prices are. The doctors don't know what tests cost.
That's exactly right. I have a standard speech that I give, and I had the same situation myself where I tried to find out what the cost of a given procedure was, and it was somewhat elective, and the doctor couldn't tell me, nor could anybody in the office tell me how much it costs. And this is a big problem as people are assuming more and more responsibility for searching for their own health care.
Why is it that way? Why don't people know what things cost, particularly professionals?
Primarily it's because, that sector is not built that way because, for the most part, because most people have insurance either through the government or their employer, and those payers pick up most of the cost, there is no incentive for consumers to seek out those prices. And conversely, there's no incentive for the healthcare industry to price services accordingly. In other words, if you look at certain healthcare services like LASIK surgery or plastic surgery, those are all elective, and those respond like the rest of the other economy. Those, you know, as technology has advanced, prices have come down. But I have a graph in my book that shows there's a company. I think it's out of Alabama that checks prices for various procedures. And they do this for companies because they want to keep a cost low. But they call around and ask for prices, things that we normally don't do. And they found, for example, for an MRI for a brain scan, within the same 20-mile radius, one facility charged $3,600 and another one charged $425. So you see this incredible spread within the same geography. And, again, most of that stuff is pretty opaque to consumers and to businesses.
Let me back up for a second, because earlier in this conversation you talked about how in this industry new technologies don't bring costs down like they do in other industries. I was going to ask you why at that point, but you just said with regard to LASIK surgery that new technology has lowered the cost. Is that because LASIK is an elective procedure, and people have to pay for it out of their own pocket, so they shop around? Is that why?
That is exactly why, Mike. So if the rest of the healthcare economy was like LASIK surgery, you would see it responding. You probably would see prices coming
down.
Why
don't we make it so?
Primarily because in most cases, most healthcare is not elective. If you've got a chronic condition, if you've got cancer, if you've got heart disease, if you have some sort of condition, you kind of have no choice but to get that, get those procedures done or those tests done, that surgery done. And so there is there's no real competition for you. You have to pay that price. And so really the medical industry does not really compete on price.
You say that wealthier nations all spend more on health care than less developed ones, but the U.S.
Correct.
Is spending well above what would be expected if you just looked at the spending of our peers. And
correct.
85% of that money goes to hospitals and physicians. Why are we such high spenders if it is true, as some believe, that our health care isn't as good as some other nations and our outcomes aren't better either?
Well, I'm going to sever those two things. First of all, in terms of why prices are so high, in most of these other nations, you have somebody in the government who is negotiating for the rest of the for the nation. In other words, and there are some European countries that'll have what they call sort of a payer, an all-payer price, so that the government sits down with all of the sectors of the economy and say, well, okay, give us your best price. And so you've got – when you do that, you're negotiating on the behalf of the entire nation. You can command lower prices. In the United States, it's all fragmented. You know, the government is one payer. You've got – you know, hundreds of healthcare plans, and those two are payers. So, and each one of those negotiate with individual providers. So, you know, you're in a situation where a given hospital has dozens and dozens and dozens of prices for a given procedure because each one of those are negotiated individually, and they try and negotiate the highest possible price they can.
And is that why the uninsured pay the most?
Yes, that's exactly right, because nobody is negotiating on their behalf. And so, you know, that's also the same case with pharmaceutical, you know, drugs are cost much, much more in this country than they do anywhere else. And that's because nearly every other country, somebody is negotiating on behalf of all of the payers, and they negotiate one price. And so, again, that brings it down.
Can you do this? Could you have a system where our prices are lower that's tailored along the same lines as those other countries without socializing medicine?
Yes, and all of these countries have various flavors of, you know, people call socialized medicine, and probably the one they point to is Great Britain, mm-hmm. You know, England, where that's really is government controlled. But, you know, the government owns the facilities and the doctors are employees and that kind of thing. But there's a lot of other countries where the insurance plans are still private, but they're nonprofit. Or there's, you know, doctors and hospitals are also privately held. So there's a lot of flavors of that. And so you can't, when you talk about those kind of economies, and particularly the sort of what we consider our peers, mostly in Europe, there are various gradations of that. So, but at this point, we do not really have an appetite for becoming more having a more regulated healthcare system. At least we don't yet. And I think until we have that, you're not going to be able to see somebody, you know, this heavy duty negotiating. I think to bring the prices down.
You point out that healthcare providers tolerate inefficiencies and, in fact, even encourage them, and they are able to, quote, do pretty much whatever they want to address medical conditions with little or no accountability for results. How can that be? Why haven't those who pay the bills, whether it's me writing the check or Blue Cross Blue Shield or Aetna writing the check, demanded both accountability and efficiency?
You know, that's a great question, Mike. I mean, at this point, a lot of businesses, and I'm thinking of the employers who are paying the freight, have really become quite alarmed by this. You know, I point out in the book that Starbucks pays more for health care or health benefits for its employees than it does for coffee beans. And you'll find that throughout the United States where businesses are paying more for health care than the raw cost of goods. So at this point, they're not doing as much as they possibly can. But there are – we can talk more about some of the strategies they're using later on.
And we will. Steve Jacobs, our guest. Healthcare in 2020, where uncertain reform, bad habits, too few doctors, and skyrocketing costs are taking us. That's the name of his book, and we're coming right back with more. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University, hosting an on-campus information session on Wednesday, February the 8th at 12 p.m. Information at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. Sushi has been making inroads in recent years in much of the country, but here in the deep-fried South, well, let's face it, it's somewhat of a mystery to most people. It's the land of meat and three and sweet tea, and some of those people look at sushi and they see raw fish on a plate. Well, it's actually far more complicated than that, with a lot more variety, and we'll meet some folks in the forefront of the sushi movement around here who help dispel some of the myths about this cuisine and maybe whet your appetite, who knows. So break out your chopsticks, we're doing that tomorrow at 9. Thank you.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, adoptees are turning to DNA tests and social media to find biological family members and trace their roots, balancing privacy with the need to know.
The Diane Rehm Show is this morning from 10 to noon, beginning right after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 FM WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Steve Jacob today, who's in Dallas. He's the author of Healthcare in 2020, which takes a look at where we're going, where we're headed, and has some, and we'll get to these, he has some suggestions on how we perhaps can get a handle on some of this, at least what we can control. We asked online listeners, Steve, what they think healthcare in 2020 should look like, and here's some of the answers we've gotten so far. Liz on Facebook says, my guess is we'll have much more issues regarding aging. We're living longer and healthier, but still face chronic illness such as arthritis and dementia, and these require constant treatment and can be quite pricey. And Art on Facebook says, only the richest of us will have health care because the insurance companies will keep jacking up the price and the Republicans will keep voting to obstruct our right to health care. Would you agree with either of those statements?
I think both of those statements are very perceptive. I probably would state a little bit more politically correctly than what they said, but I think both of those points are absolutely true. Between now and I'm going to take it 5 years beyond my book to 2025, but basically it looks as though we're going to need about 30% more primary care, and that's the physicians such as family physicians, pediatricians, internists, those are the doctors we go see first before we see specialists. And the demand is going to be about 30% greater for those doctors by 2025, for the very reason that the first person you cited mentioned, in that we're going to have an aging population, but also because we'll have 32 million more people with health insurance because of health reform. But the doctor supply is only going to grow by about 2 to 7%, so it's going to be a pretty tough situation to address the second point that the general was making about
obstructionism,
the cost of healthcare. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I basically took the healthcare costs, the trajectory of healthcare costs on an individual household going back 10 years and then projected it forward 10 years. And essentially, for a family of four, the percentage of household income devoted to health care costs will be about 17%. And the rule of thumb is that if it reaches 10%, that is a burden, a financial burden. And so we're looking at a financial burden on the average household in the United States. And that's a pretty scary thought.
Do you think most people realize that?
I'm not sure. I don't think they do. I think, again, because, it's the old cliche about the frog in the boiling pot. The temperature keeps getting turned up a little bit more each year. Mm-hmm. And people get stunned by this mostly when they enter the healthcare system, because when they have a problem or a procedure done, and they're just stunned by the costs of everything. And that's obviously the best way to do is keep yourself out of harm's way.
So let's repeat those numbers, because you say that you say this in the book, you just said it here on the air, that healthcare costs become a financial burden when out-of-pocket costs for a person or a family reach 10% of household income. And by 2020, just 8 years from now, those costs are expected to exceed 17% for a family of four, even with the Obama plan, even if it stays intact exactly the way it is?
Yes, because the Obama plan really does not affect costs. I mean, there's a few provisions in there, and they're very detailed. It's a big, long bill, but that attempt to try and address some of these things. But it doesn't address the two major things that I pointed out earlier, which is the dispersion of technology broadly, and probably too broadly. And the other thing is the market power of these healthcare systems that can command high prices. Let me just make one addendum to that. I was saying it's 17% the average household nationally. Now, I calculated those costs for North Carolina, and actually North Carolina is one of the best in the nation on this measure, but it's still going to be 9%. of household income in North Carolina.
And why is that? Why are we different?
Well, I think it's got to do with the fact that, you know, I think your household income is probably a little bit better than a lot of these states. And also, you know, some of the health care costs
well,
have
only
gone
if
up
you're Mississippi or Alabama.
Yeah, well, that's true. You know, where I think North Carolina is going to have a bigger problem is access to care, because there was a study done in the New England Journal of Medicine that kind of created an index of, you know, how many primary care providers are there, and then how many people are going to get on Medicaid. Yeah. And North Carolina was among the most challenged states there. And North Carolina is also going to face kind of the same thing we face here in Texas, in that I believe that you are going to add, just through health reform, you're going to add about 800,000 more people are going to have health insurance in North Carolina. And then you add the fact that you're also a growing state. So those two factors combined create a whole lot more people, a lot more demand for health care, and you're not growing suppliers.
You wrote an article for the Charlotte Observer about kind of taking your book and drilling it down to North Carolina.
Yes.
And you mentioned that the in terms of insurance premiums, if things continue as you think they will by 2020, the average premium for insurance would be $23,402 a year, compared with $13,752 in 2010. The average employee's share of that premium would be about $6,400 as compared to $3,400, almost $3,500 last year or in 2010. The average deductible would go from $1,932 to $3,700, and the average employee share of the premium and deductible combined would be about 9%. That's where you come up with that 9% figure, 9% of projected median household income. What does that mean for a family of four when you take that chunk of money out of their salary? Or what does it mean for the economy at large? Will people stop buying other things because they're spending on health care? Or will they stop seeking health care?
Really, it's both of those things. It depends on what your health is. Last year, 4 out of 10 Americans had what they call unmet health needs because of costs. And that strictly means that you have a problem, but you couldn't afford to treat it. So that is certainly the case. And now, obviously, if you end up with a situation where you have a health episode or some sort of problem, you do have to forego other things. And and usually when people pick between their health and paying the utility bill, they usually end up picking the utility bill. Hmm. So, you know, if you look at what's happened in the last 10 years, I was just looking at a study yesterday from the Health Affairs Journal, and what they went back 10 years and then projected forward, and then they sort of accounted for inflation, and they essentially said that if healthcare costs rose, you know, like all other consumer prices for the last 10 years, we would all have $5,000 more annually in our pocket to spend on other things. And they said with that inflation that essentially the average household only had $95 more a year for non-health spending. Over, you know, that's what all they had to show for 10 years. I have a graph in my book, and you know, pardon me for all these numbers, but essentially, stick with me. If you go back to 1999. To 2010, inflation went up 31%. Workers' earnings went up 42%. Health insurance premiums went up 138%. And then workers' contributions to those premiums, in other words, the piece that workers had to pay, went up 159%. So you can see, if you take that graphic that I had in my book and then what I just told you about what's happened in the last 10 years, you can see that essentially workers' increases in salary are essentially going to health care.
Right. Well, let me use another figure that you use in the book that really people can understand. You say that if gasoline prices had risen as much as health care spending since 1980, we would now be paying $9 per gallon. Now, we would not stand for that in America.
We sure would not.
Worse, the economy would have crumbled. So why are we so reluctant to want to do anything to fix this problem?
Because politicians are extremely reluctant to say, we will pay for X and not Y. At this point, we don't really dictate how physicians and healthcare facilities treat us. And they pay for anything they think that is even remotely reasonable. And that what they mean is it reasonable for somebody's care, not in terms of how much it costs. So if people, and again, we could do several more programs on so many instances of overinflated procedures that are done that are of no benefit to the patient. In other words, the most commonly cited statistic is about 30% of medical costs are wasted. In other words, there were procedures that didn't need to be done. They were prescriptions that did not need to be taken. So at this point, nobody's willing to say no. And that, of course, gets back to everybody's afraid of the word rationing. But what we're not really ready to have an adult conversation. Rationing sort of assumes that you're withholding needed medical treatment. And there's a whole lot of evidence that there's a lot of treatments that are giving that are of no benefit.
You say that the Obama program was largely shaped by the healthcare industry. So the Obama program is really a program designed, as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, to give access to more people through forcing them to buy health insurance. And if they can't pay for the health insurance, then the government will step in and help them do that. Is that in essence correct?
Yeah. And okay. Let me take it one step further, that most of the funding for that came from the healthcare industry. In other words, everybody think of a little campfire and representatives from all of the let me use a different not a campfire. Let's say that they're all sitting around a table and there's a hat in the middle of the table, and you have all these healthcare interests. What everybody does is throws a little something into the hat to pay for healthcare reform. Hospitals agreed to take less money for Medicare. Pharmaceutical industry gave huge discounts, particularly for the Medicare Part D program. Medical device makers said, hey, we're willing to take these fees. So everybody kind of threw this money into the pot. But this was in exchange for the individual mandate, making sure that everybody has to have health insurance. So what they were doing is saying, we're going to fund, this expansion of health insurance, kind of with the idea that this is going to grow the market for medical care. So they pretty much shaped this law, but they also funded it, with the idea that this was sort of that they're going to get a return on their investment.
Yeah, they'll be making more money because more people will be in the system. And even though they'll have to cover people with pre-existing conditions, they'll still make more money because more people will be throwing money into the pot.
That's exactly right. And
does
you know,
that
economists
not work?
Sort of
is that a good idea?
Well, I think on another level, there are a lot of things that the health reform did that really needed to happen. The pre-existing conditions, mm-hmm. That's an extremely unjust part of the United States healthcare.
Portability
yeah. too. Yeah, all these things were really important. So I think in that respect, it was a good idea. But again, my fear and kind of one of the major reasons I wrote this book is I think people are sort of sitting back waiting to see, well, gee, is health reform going to happen? And if it does, it's got the word reform in it, it's going to kind of fix all these problems. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is the bigger problems of access and affordability are there. And, one could argue what we're doing is unleashing 32 million more people on a very flawed system.
Yeah. Well, you start your book by stating that if the Obama health care plan survives, it will be fully implemented by 2020, bringing more changes in 10 years than have happened in the last 50. But those changes will also hit, and you've kind of alluded to this already, will hit at a time when 40% of the nation's doctors will have reached retirement age and when we will probably be experiencing a nursing shortage.
That's
obviously
correct.
The implications of that are disastrous. Why aren't there 8 years away? There's enough time to go to medical school for some people. Why aren't they rushing to the entrances of medical schools? Because it seems to me there's a pot of money on the other side.
You know, that's a great point, Mike. And what I'm seeing in Texas, and again, all this is played out. A lot of this is played out on a state level. But what you're finding is that, and there's two things that need to be funded. One is the medical schools, and the other is residencies. You know, in other words, once people go to medical school, then they have to do 2 or 3 years of residency in order to become a doctor. And what's being choked off are those residencies. Even though some medical schools are expanding, you have to have enough residencies to truly train them, and that's just not happening. And I think the major reason for that is that governments are very reluctant to cut benefits, and what they will do is cut things like medical residencies because they feel like voters really don't kind of understand that. But we're kind of eating our own seed corn. And it's really sad. Now, one thing about the aging doctors, I did pull out something from the Association of American Medical Colleges, and they have a statistic about how many doctors are 60 or older. And North Carolina, thankfully, has the lowest rate of any state of the number of doctors who are 60 or older, but it's 20%. You know, nationally, that's more like it's about 26%. So you have fewer doctors over 60, but that's still kind of alarming that one out of five, you know, very well will not be practicing in 10 years.
Getting back to some comments from our listeners on Facebook, Philip wants to know whether your calculations about 2020 medical costs include the health insurance costs or just the costs of medical care.
No, it does include the insurance costs. Mine come from it's called the Milliman Medical Index. And what it does every year is calculates the cost of health care for a family of four. And that is all the costs. And that's the insurance cost. That's fully loaded. And then what I did was even though they come up with this cost, which I'm doing this off the top of my head, but for the family of four, it's going to be about $38,000 in 2020. Mm-hmm. Then what I did was looked at, okay, what's really going to come out of pocket? Because, you know, again, still the average for the average household of four, more than half the costs are being picked up by employer insurance or by the government insurance. So what I did was I dialed that back and just looked at the you know, even though households are paying a little bit more each year in terms of the percentage of their health care costs, that's where that comes from. Mm-hmm. So it's the out-of-pocket cost for everything for a family of four.
And a comment on the web by one of our listeners named Jerry. Why prices go up? High tech, high cost services demanded by consumers and paid for by others. Limited supply, unlimited demand. What else would you expect? And I would imagine that you would agree with that.
I absolutely, you know, he hit every note. Good job.
Steve Jacob is our guest. Healthcare in 2020, where uncertain reform, bad habits, too few doctors, and skyrocketing costs are taking us. That's the name of his book. We're going to come back and take some listener calls and also find out what we can do to maybe help ourselves eliminate some of these problems. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McCall Center for Visual Art, welcoming the public to a gallery reception Friday, January 27th from 6 to 9 p.m. featuring Converge, an exhibition that explores art, identity, and culture. Details at McCallCenter.org. Adult adoptees are turning to DNA tests and to social media to find biological family members and trace their roots. So, at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, balancing privacy with the need to know. That's the topic at 10. And if you'd like to join our conversation right now with Steve Jacob, author of Healthcare in 2020, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
In my family, the secret was me. I was secret because I was black. These days you'd say I was biracial. But in the 50s, when you were born, there was no biracial. You were either born black or you were born white. End of story.
Join us for more true stories told live next time on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
It's Friday night at 8 at 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. On a sidebar topic, the News and Observer in Raleigh, the Washington Post, the Charlotte Observer are reporting that the Governor Beverly Perdue will not seek re-election. WFAE News is seeking confirmation of that. We'll have reports later on today about that. Our guest this hour is Steve Jacob, a healthcare award-winning healthcare journalist, has written Healthcare in 2020. And before we talk about some of the things that we can do to help control our own costs and improve our access to, or our, maybe reduce our need for access to healthcare, let's take a couple of listener calls here. Jeff in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to talk to you again, Mike, and great subject. I've got two quick anecdotes. I'll try to be short. I apologize. I used to be in the healthcare business.
Mm-hmm.
First one, I was in a meeting listening to some 34 senior executives who controlled a large body of hospitals, not-for-profit. We were trying, I was in the healthcare Six Sigma business of reducing costs, and that was what the meeting was about. 30 minutes into the meeting, the senior of all this group stood up and said, "This meeting is a waste of my time. If Buffy needs a kidney, the entire neighborhood will have raffles and bake sales until they have the money." And he walked out of the room. So you've got that one kind of attitude. I think it's still out there. The other anecdote, very quickly, in the 1840s in Boston, if you had fire insurance, the fire department was controlled by the health care insurance or the fire insurance company. And they would show up at your door, and if you had a medallion on the side of your house that was that insurance company, they would put the fire out. If it wasn't, they watched it burn. If the house next to you was burning and it wasn't part of the medallion system, they watched it burn. So eventually, cities took over fire provision instead of – they left the insurance companies to do what they do best, which is spread risk. That's their best job, but they can't provide the service. And that's part of our problem. You've got people who won't put out the fires because you're not part of their system, or they're there to increase shareholder value by denying service. It's just a mess. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay, Steve. I'm glad it's you and not me.
Yeah, I was really interested in Jeff's, particularly his first story, because I think that's it's very instructive. And this is, I guess, kind of a local story, too, in the sense that it was in the 1990s when Duke University Hospital basically did a study where they were able to, use some Six Sigma kind of ways of reducing costs, and they got the cost well under control for a given procedure. And I don't recall what the procedure was right offhand, but essentially, once they were able to do it, I think they reduced the cost by 40% by doing all the right things. And then once they did that, they realized by doing all these things, they were losing money by saving, so the idea is if they, that's another quirk of the healthcare industry. In other words, if a facility cuts costs, they're not the ones necessarily that gain, from those cost cuts. It's the people who are paying. So, if the provider is striving to provide the most efficient care, the way we're set up, which is what's called a fee-for-service system, there's no incentive there to try and save anybody else any money. So really the incentive is more to try and run up the bill. The more care you provide, the more money you get.
Okay. Doyle in Charlotte, welcome to the program. Hello, Doyle.
Oh, yes. Hello. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I think it's fair to say that a dramatic increase in healthcare costs is itself a form of rationing. So, I have trouble with the term rationing because that's, in essence, what's being done right now. And healthcare costs are something, unfortunately, a consumer like myself who has an individual policy with Blue Cross Blue Shield cannot really negotiate anything. We have to rely on the insurance company to do the negotiating for us. And without any knowledge of the costs of certain procedures. So So that's a real problem. And the doctors themselves don't really know what the costs are either. And that's a real problem. As an example of that, I had a recent experience with one of the two healthcare companies here in Charlotte, one of the big hospitals, and they have a satellite office. And my wife was having a procedure done, a test, and instead of sending her to a freestanding imaging clinic, they sent her to a hospital. And the bill for the service was dramatically increased as a result of that. And we did have the option of going to an imaging center instead. So when I got the bill, I contacted the healthcare provider that operated the hospital. And they were very concerned, and they listened to my argument. And they came to the conclusion that that was the wrong thing to do. But it just shows, and they're going to not make me pay for it. But the problem is that neither the patients nor the doctors really understand the costs of the tests and the procedures that
right,
they're
requiring. Right, which is something we kind of talked about, touched on earlier in our conversation. And that's not going to change, you think, Steve?
No. I mean, at this point, I think a lot of people give lip service to that. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I don't see any significant movement toward giving consumers the tools they need to be able to look up their care. And the other point that the caller made, and it's an excellent one, is that's exactly how we ration in this country, is by insurance. If you're uninsured, that's how we ration care, because if you're uninsured, you're much less likely to get care. And also we ration by price. I think through health reform, we're going to ration a different way. In other words, once people do in fact have insurance, that piece of that rationing goes away, and we'll then have a rationing of access. In other words, rationing by waiting because you won't be able to get in to see a physician.
Which was the great fear of those who were opposed to any kind of government intervention in healthcare.
Yes. If you look at Massachusetts, which has had health reform since 2006, and again, it really is Romney care. but back then, before they started that reform, it took 17 days to get an appointment with a doctor for a new patient, and now that has grown to 48 days. Hmm. In 2011, and Massachusetts is like among the top three in terms of the number of doctors available. Texas and North Carolina don't have nearly the number of doctors they have in Massachusetts, so it could be a real mess.
Doyle, thank you for your call. You assert that the only way to control costs is to limit our use, our own limiting of our use of the healthcare system, and that means that we have to take control of our own health. But you also say, I believe, that employees really have no – because employees who are covered under their employer's healthcare have no motivation to stay healthy. So how do – because it's covered. So how do you convince people to change their behaviors if their employers are picking up the tab when they're fat and they're unhealthy? Or they're smoking and they're unhealthy. Or they won't exercise and they're unhealthy.
Yeah, it's really a real conundrum, because people think in terms of costs, and they feel like, well, gee, if something happens to me, somebody's going to take care of me. And I was interested in that story at the top of the hour where they were talking about how, you know, by 55, your cardiovascular risk is pretty much, you know, baked in. If you've taken care of yourself up to age 55, you know, you're pretty much bulletproof in terms of having heart disease. And they say if you just do three things, if you exercise and if you eat right, and you maintain a normal weight, that cuts your risk of heart disease, cancer, and diabetes by 80%. So that in and of itself should be enough motivation. Sure, somebody else maybe pick up the cost, and they're probably not going to pick up as much of the cost as you think they are. But assuming that's even the case, you're leading a diminished life.
Yeah.
If you're not taking care of yourself.
Well, a lot of chronic diseases are caused by – they're self-inflicted. They're caused by our behaviors.
Yes.
Or our bad behaviors. And one of your chapters is called Life Expectancy Going in the Wrong Direction. And in that chapter, you say that what controls health and therefore premature death is behavior coupled with life circumstances, environmental exposures, medical care, and our genes. And surprisingly, medical care only affects about 10% of premature deaths. The biggest factor, you say, is behavior.
Yes. You know, so many people want to make these things a medical problem. You know, obesity is not a medical problem. That's a lifestyle and cultural problem. We've wrung movement out of our life with technology. We have, you know, we have food and beverage companies spending billions trying to convince us to consume and overconsume their products. So, you know, we have to fight against that. But, you know, there's a big payoff in the end. The healthiest 50% of Americans spend 3% of the healthcare dollars. In other words, if you're pretty much healthy in a given year, you're spending only out of pocket maybe a little over $200. But if you're among the top 10%, you're spending $24,000. You know, if you're the top 1%, you're spending over $75,000. So once you enter the medical system for a given condition, or an episode, a heart attack, or you know, cancer, or whatever, you're pretty much at the whims of the system. That's how you really rack up a major bill. So the best way to do that is to avoid it as much as possible. And so, you know, behavior, as I said, makes up 40% of it, and then genes are 30%. But that's not necessarily the destiny. And in healthcare, there's a saying that says that genes load the gun, but environment and behavior pull the trigger.
Well, in fact, as we go forward, and they're already working on this, altering genes or targeting things at your genes, personalized medicine may actually reduce the impact of genetic factors. Might they not?
Possibly. I mean, they're now talking about doing a personal genome. 5 years ago cost $350,000, and they're now talking about a one-day, $1,000 genome by the end of the year. And so that can uncover an awful lot of things. Now, you know, one of the promises of personalized medicine is that if they know your genetic makeup, they can target specific drugs to your genetic makeup and make them much more effective. But we still are on the hook for all these other things in terms of taking care of ourselves. And in other words, we still do pull the trigger with our behavior and our social circumstances, some of which are under our control.
So eating right, I mean, obesity, the epidemic that we're facing right now, is not only going to kill the people who are obese, it's going to kill us economically, because we're going to have to take care of them, whether there's a health care plan by the government designed to do that or whether they go to the emergency room. We're taking care of those people.
Yes, and I've seen studies, and I'm a little skeptical of them, but I've seen a peer-reviewed study in one of the major health journals basically saying that obesity accounted for nearly all of the increases in Medicare from, you know, the late 1980s through the, you know, early part of this past decade. So it is a big contributor to costs. But it's not nearly as big as it's still is dwarfed by the two things I talked about, which is technology and prices.
So eating right and eating the right foods and adding the right foods to our diet and taking out the wrong foods can help us get some control over our health care going forward. But it's not just that. The most important of all the behaviors that you talk about and is the one that most Americans don't do. Exercise. You call it the fountain of youth. Really?
Yes. I mean, if you looked at all the individual health behaviors, the one that is the most robust, the one that makes the most difference, is exercise. And it's, we have a Cooper Wellness and Cooper Institute in Dallas, and they're now working on a book that it's a study after study after study that shows that if you exercise, it negates all these other things. In other words, if you are exercise and are overweight or even obese, you are in better shape than a normal weight person who does not exercise. You can undo some of the damage of smoking by exercising. You can undo some of the damage of drinking too much by exercising. So it's the best thing you could do to dial things back. But
and you're talking 30 minutes a day, right?
Well, I mean, the government is it recommends that 30 minutes. I think they say 150 minutes a week. And we're really kind of poor judges of whether we're getting enough exercise. There was a study I cited in there where 40% of the people said, oh, yeah, I get enough exercise. And then they put a contraption on them called it's an accelerometer, which actually measures your actual movement. And it turns out only 4% of them were getting enough exercise. So there's a lot we can do to move the needle on that. And that probably more than anything else is the most important thing to do.
But even if we all took more responsibility for our own health, if we all exercised, ate right, stopped consuming tobacco products, drank only in moderation, there would still be chronic disease. There would still be people suffering as a result of accidents. There would still be that person who does everything right and comes down with cancer. So wouldn't caring for those people still take an enormous amount of resources in terms of dollars and medical personnel? And are we equipped to handle even that if everybody did the right things?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We are more than equipped to handle all that if everybody was doing the right thing. I mean, you're talking about it, the statistic I mentioned before. By doing even some of those things, we could cut chronic disease by 80%. And chronic disease accounts for about 75% of healthcare dollars. So it would make a huge difference.
Steve Jacob is our guest, has been our guest. He is an award-winning healthcare journalist in newspapers across the country. His book is called Healthcare in 2020, where uncertain reform, bad habits, too few doctors, skyrocketing costs are taking us. And if you want to get a really good understanding of how we got to where we are, where we're headed, and what we can do to maybe head it off at the pass, pick it up. It's easy to read. It is not a difficult book. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.